Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 13, Chapter 7. Meanwhile, another column was to have attacked the French from the front, but Kutuzov accompanied that column. He well knew that nothing but confusion would come of this battle undertaken against his will, and as far as was in his power, held the troops back. He did not advance. He rode silently on his small grey horse, indolently answering suggestions that they should attack. The word attack is always on your tongue, but you don't see that we are unable to execute complicated manoeuvres, said he to Miloradovic, who asked permission to advance. We could take Murat prisoner this morning, or get to the place in time, and nothing can be done now, he replied to someone else. When Kutuzov was informed that at the French rear, where, according to the reports of the Cossacks, there had previously been nobody, there were now two battalions of Poles, he gave a sidelong glance at Ermolov, who was behind him and to whom he had not spoken since the previous day. You see, they are asking to attack and making plans of all kinds, but as soon as one gets to business, nothing is ready, and the enemy, forewarned, takes measures accordingly. Ermolov screwed up his eyes and smiled faintly on hearing these words. He understood that for him the storm had blown over, and that Kutuzov would content himself with that hint. He's having a little fun at my expense, said Ermolov softly, nudging with his knee Ravetsky, who was at his side. Soon after this, Ermolov moved up to Kutuzov and respectfully remarked, It is not too late yet, Your Highness. The enemy has not gone away. If you were to order an attack, if not, the guards will not so much as see a little smoke. Kutuzov did not reply, but when they reported to him that Murat's troops were in retreat, he ordered an advance, though at every 100 paces he halted for 3/4 of an hour. The whole battle consisted in what all of Denisov's Cossacks had done. The rest of the army merely lost some hundreds of men uselessly. In consequence of this battle, Kutuzov received a diamond decoration, and Bennigsen some diamonds and 100,000 rubles. Others also received pleasant recognitions corresponding to their various grades, and following the battle, fresh changes were made in the staff. That's how everything is done with us, all topsy-turvy, said the Russian officers and generals after the Turritino battle, letting it be understood that some fool there is doing things all wrong, but that we ourselves should not have done so, just as people speak today. But people who talk like that neither do not know what they are talking about, or deliberately deceive themselves. No battle, Turritino, Borodino, or Austerlitz, takes place as those who planned it anticipated. That is an essential condition. Countless number of free forces, for nowhere is man freer than during a battle, where it is a question of life and death, influence the course taken by the fight, and that course never can be known in advance, and never coincides with the direction of any one force. If many simultaneously and variously directed forces act on a given body, the direction of its motion cannot coincide with any one of those forces, but will always be a mean, what in mechanics is represented by the diagonal of a parallelogram of forces. If in the descriptions given by historians, especially French ones, we find their wars and battles carried out in accordance with previously formed plans, the only conclusion to be drawn is that those descriptions are false. The Battle of Turritino obviously did not attain the aim Toll had in view, to lead the troops into action in the order prescribed by the dispositions, nor that which Count Orlov Denisov may have had in view, to take Murat prisoner, nor the result of immediately destroying the whole corps, which Bennigsen and others may have had in view, nor the aim of the officer who wished to go into action to distinguish himself, nor that of the Cossack who wanted more booty than he got, and so on. But if the aim of the battle was what actually resulted, and what all the Russians of that day desired, to drive the French out of Russia and destroy their army, it is quite clear that the Battle of Tarutino, just because of its incongruities, was exactly what was wanted at that stage of the campaign. It would be difficult, and even impossible, to imagine any result more opportune than the actual outcome of this battle. With a minimum of effort, and insignificant losses, despite the greatest confusion, the most important results of the whole campaign were attained. The transition from retreat to advance, and exposure of the weaknesses of the French, and the administration of that shock which Napoleon's army had only awaited to begin its flight. Alright, there we go, another chapter down, and the tables have officially turned. The Russians are on the attack, and the French are on the retreat. Finally. Who was once delight said, "That's how it's always done with us, all the wrong way around," the Russian officers and generals said after the Battle of Tarutino, just as people speak now, letting it be felt that some fool somewhere does things that way, the wrong way round, but we would not do things that way. But people who talk like that either do not know what they are talking about or are deliberately deceiving themselves. That's a slightly different translation from what we had. That's from the PNV version, as opposed to the Maud version that we're reading. I think I liked the Maud version better, because that one had a little bit of tongue-twistery alliteration in it, like wrong way round. I don't like wrong way round. It sort of comes off a bit goofy to me to try to say that. Who was once delight said, "As someone in public education, this quote really resonated with me. I'm sure I've made similar complaints about our district supervisors, and I imagine many people who work in bureaucratic systems feel the same way. Do you find this to be true? If so, do those who think this way know what we are talking about, or are we deliberately deceiving ourselves?" Mag019 said, "This quote is corporate America all around. As I've progressed in my career, I shudder at the statements I made previously where I didn't understand the office politics and red tape. Years later, I get why things are done the way they are now." It's one of those funny kind of quotes, because it ends by saying, people who talk like that either do not know what they are talking about or are deliberately deceiving themselves. And that's a very accusatory statement, right? But then it's also kind of what those people are saying in the first place. General said, "That's how it's always done, all the wrong way around. Just as people speak now, letting it be felt that some fool somewhere does things that way, the wrong way, but we do not do things that way." Right? So someone's saying that, well, the way we do it is right and everyone else is wrong. And then the commentary on that directly after is that the only people who say that are people who don't know what they're talking about. So it's just people flinging mud at each other, really, isn't it? Because they're pretty much saying the same thing about each other. People always get muddled up and say the wrong thing. Oh, only people who are muddled up say that, and they're wrong. Essentially is how I would unravel that. Oh, God, it makes my head spin, actually. But yeah, that's bureaucracy for you in a nutshell. Who was once delight also said, "Nowhere is a man more free than in battle, where it is a question of life and death." This is quite an assertion. What do you think Tolstoy means by this statement, and do you agree with it? Original CJ5 said, "I think Tolstoy is a bit too critical about the planning, or lack thereof, during battles. It might have involved too many errors during his time, but I don't think it happening now. Don't think it's happening now with the advanced equipment that the military has." Thoughts. Personal Unreal said, "Maybe less so, but I think there is still a lot of randomness involved. Just think about the last election. Not a soul or any of the advanced polling technologies predicted Trump's presidency. I think at the end of the day there are so many factors influencing history that there is just no way of predicting or controlling a vast majority of events. Reading War and Peace opened my eyes to how limited historical accounts often are, and I find Tolstoy's analysis and philosophical conclusions fascinating. You know, I think we've just made it 286 days in a row without mentioning Trump. I might be wrong, but personal and real, you broke the record of days in a row without mentioning Trump. I didn't really want to get political, especially about today's politics, because, I don't know, it's all I hear about. This is my break from that, you know? But, yeah. I actually read this chapter thinking, armies, militaries run a tighter ship these days, and I think they're capable of far more impressive strategic maneuvers, far more impressive organizational skills, and just their techniques, even techniques involving just to keep morale up, I think, because such a big thing in this book has been how the army feels before a fight or after a fight or before or after a defeat, and it plays such a huge role in their actions, is their morale. And I think today, I just think we'd have better ways of keeping a handle on that. Although, you know, this is completely speculative because I am in no way a military person. I've never been in any military situation, so I don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe I should move on. Anyway, it was cool to see that in today's chapter we switched from defensive to offensive, and that although it didn't go as planned, it did go fairly well. So that's good. It's all downhill from here, right? We're closing in on the end of the book. Now, I'm going to leave you today with something a bit different. Today I went on a local radio station out in the Yarra Valley, just a little local one, probably only a handful of listeners, but I spoke to Anne Krieber and John on The Good Life, which is a show about literature and the arts, and they often have authors on as guests or different people in sort of the book world. And I went on their show today to talk specifically about A Year of War and Peace and about the podcast that I'm doing and about this community as well. I also spoke about Launchpad and some of the other things I've got going on more locally. We chatted for about half an hour, I think, maybe even a little longer. So I thought what I'd leave you with today is that conversation, which I can put into this episode. So I'll say thank you now, but stick around if you want to hear that conversation. Thanks very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Enjoy this little chat with myself, Anne, and John from The Good Life.
Wow. It's a classy show.
It is indeed. And we're going to be talking War and Peace.
War and Peace. Mm-hmm. That's a good topic. Big topic.
A big topic, yes. But we're going to simplify it for you.
Ah, excellent. Well done.
We have a guest who's taken all mm-hmm. the hard work out of it for you.
Yep, all right.
And all you do is to have to sit back with a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, mm-hmm. and he'll do the rest.
Oh, excellent, excellent. And, of course, we're in the middle of a radiothon, which we'll tell you a little bit more about shortly.
Yes, be warned, be warned. Yeah. We're going to be bombarded with
it. Yeah, we're going to spruik a little bit. You know, it's a good
not
thing.
Not me, I'm not. That's not my role.
No, well, you could. You could add a little bit of extra to it. Yeah.
And then I'm going to be talking to an author whose book I absolutely loved. It's a little book, mm-hmm. book with great cover. Mm-hmm. And it's called, I think it's called The Road to Tralfamadore is Bathed in River Water.
Mm.
I'll have to get the author to correct the pronunciation.
It's not a little book. It's a standard size book, but it's a little thin.
Oh, it's a small book as well. It's the size of the little old penguins you used to buy. It's a handbag size book, I call it.
Oh, really?
Perfect for travelling on trains. No, it's a lovely book. I just loved it.
I can't wait to hear more about this book.
So she's coming in, hopefully.
Lovely, yeah.
Her publicist. And then we're going to be talking art.
Okay.
At Tarawarra, which as usual is doing something quite adventurous and exciting, and there's a big day coming up next Saturday that we want to tell people about, so I'm talking to their curator about that. So there you go.
It's all happening, folks. Well, we don't need to play music because we've got a guest in the studio now.
We do. And our first guest is not new to, well, he's not new to The Good Life, but he's new to this studio. Well done.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks, John.
I was a bit nervous he might get lost, but he's an Uber driver, among other things. He's a man of multi-skills.
We better give his name out.
Well, I'm just keeping him in suspense.
His name is
Ander Louis. I hope I'm pronouncing his surname Louis. Louis.
Oh, Lewis.
Lewis. You call it Lewis. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Spelled L-O-U-I-S.
Yeah. I believe that's the French one is Louis.
That's right.
And Italian, Lewis.
So where does Louis Armstrong come from? Is it Louis Armstrong or Louis Armstrong?
Louis Armstrong.
You
he
sure?
called himself Louis Armstrong, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Other people called him Louis.
I inherited the name from my grandfather, so you have to take it up with him.
I don't think that's unreasonable. The last time you were here, you were speaking to us about a project you had, writing workshops for school kids. John, what are you doing?
Nothing.
Well, don't do it again.
that's Launchpad. Yeah, I'm still doing that.
How do you fit it all in?
That's a good question. I just stay busy, I suppose. I'm lucky enough that I can do most of my work from home, other than the Uber driving, obviously, but
coming to 3MDR for interviews.
True.
Well, I'm very grateful you did. You made the effort to get here today. But you're obviously a man who's enjoyed war and peace yourself over the years, and you wanted to share it.
You'd think that, but no, I'm actually new to it.
Oh, are you?
Yeah. So this project, this A Year of War and Peace, it's a daily reading of the book. So the book, I'm not sure if you knew, it happens to have 365 chapters.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew it was a very, very long book, a dauntingly long book, but I didn't realise it was 365.
Yeah, a little bit of background behind the book. That'd be kind of nice.
Yeah. Well, so hence A Year of War and Peace, because 365 chapters at one chapter a day. You'll read the book in 1 year.
Mm.
Right. So what happened with me is I've always meant to read the book.
We all do.
Yeah, you were saying before, yeah. With my students, my writing students, I always say it's the one book every author must read, but none of them ever do.
Mm-hmm.
So I embarked to change that. But
setting a good example.
Trying to, yeah. But I stumbled across on a forum, a website called Reddit. They were talking about New Year's resolutions on the 1st of January this year. And someone mentioned that to read War and Peace one chapter per day was their New Year's resolution, and they will have it finished by 2019. This became a really popular concept, and a few thousand people subscribed to do the same thing.
I wonder how many have persisted.
Quite a few, yeah. So they made their own forum, and every day we all read the same chapter, and then there's a discussion about that chapter.
That's interesting.
It's really cool, yeah. And because there's over 2,000 people participating, some of them are experts, some of them are new, some of all around the world, all different walks of life. All I did was put my hand up and said, hey, I could turn this into a podcast. So I read the chapter out, like an audiobook.
Well, that must be exhausting in itself, to make that commitment every day.
Yeah. I took the plunge, you know. I saw the opportunity and I thought, oh, this could be really cool. I've always wanted to read it. As a sort of a leader in teaching literature, it seems like I should go a bit more in depth than just reading it, but make a project.
And I suppose in a sense it's discipline. Now you've committed yourself. It'd be very embarrassing if you said, enough of it. I can't go on.
This last week I've had a chest infection and a throat infection. I've been barely able to talk, but I've pushed through. It's the last thing I do every night before I go to bed is I put the microphone on, I read the day's chapter, and then after that I read through the discussion forum about the chapter.
I
kind of have a little conversation with the comments.
So you don't sleep, that's how you do all these things, obviously.
I've got it down to a fine art. You know, when you break the book down into 365 parts, the chapters are quite short.
Are they?
They're 2 to 3 pages each.
Oh, that's not so, so bad.
Yeah, about 10 minutes of reading on average.
That's not bad.
Followed by...
It's a commitment, though. It's a discipline, isn't it, having to do it, regardless of how you feel, as you say, with a chest infection.
Yep, yep. Good and bad days, you've got to turn the mic on.
So if you, you've got a whole year there, most people take a holiday throughout the year, like they go, you know, wherever. How are you going to cope with that sort of arrangement?
Well, it's been 285 days now.
I was going to ask how many.
And I haven't hadn't had a day where I've had to, you know, get one in the bank for the day previous or anything like that. Just so happens I'm a bit of a homebody. I just stay home. And so it hasn't been a problem. I actually don't think I've been on a holiday for about 4 or 5 years.
Oh.
I'm a small business owner, so I work around
committed.
The clock.
You're
Sounds like you had fun anyway. So
I love it. Yeah, it's really interesting.
And you probably don't watch television.
I do actually.
Do
yeah, that's my vice. Yeah.
You're amazing, isn't he?
Yeah.
I think he's found the secret of working, you know, 36 hours a day one day.
Well, I said it's the last thing I do before I go to bed, but that's kind of a lie. It's the last thing before I do, before I jump on the couch and watch some sort of mindless TV. Most nights I fall
switch
asleep
off.
On the
mentally
couch.
Switch off.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a couch sleeper.
Oh, you know?
I probably. More often than not, I sleep on the couch just because that's where I fall asleep.
Do you have a cat or a dog?
No. No, I don't.
Well, most people who sleep on couches, you know, put their photographs up on Facebook with a cat or a dog curled up beside them.
I have a dog, but she lives with my grandma now because she's got a bit more land for it to run around on. Mm. But not at home, no, I don't. Yeah.
And you're still driving Uber?
Yeah, I am. It goes up and down with that. The good thing about that is you can... fill in the gaps. So because my launch pad is my main income and that's determined by the school year, so it's a school program. So at times when it's quiet or the school holidays,
you've been on holiday now.
I become a full-time Uber driver for a little while, and then the early in the year there was a period of I think 4 or 5 months where I didn't have to Uber drive once. And that was sort of my record since becoming a small business owner. Like the business was actually supporting me.
You were able to concentrate on the business.
So that was pretty
great.
Cool.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And how long have you actually been involved with the teaching classes, reading, writing classes?
That started in 2015. Middle King Lake Primary School invited me to do an author visit. I'm actually a writer myself.
Yes, I know that.
They read my book. Their librarian read my book. She invited me to come to the school, and I said to her, look, I don't want to just visit and say, hey, I'm an author, how cool is that? I want to do something with the kids.
Something productive.
Creative, yeah. Mm. So we came up with this idea to make a book together, which we did. So we made this anthology of stories. All the kids had their own short stories in the book. I helped them write them. And then we had a book launch, and the book came out in paperback, like
yes,
a real thing.
So yeah. I had a copy.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. So that was 2015, and... yeah, that kind of became popular, so other schools wanted to do it, and that became a small business. And
it's great. I think it's a wonderful way of encouraging kids to read and to write, even more importantly.
To become book people,
indeed.
Which is something I aspire to do myself. You know, when I can drop the Uber bit out of my life, all these various things that I do will be book things, writing, teaching, publishing, all this. So that's what I aspire to be myself.
Books are, you know, I can't imagine people living without books. My husband used to say, you know, if he was on a desert island, he couldn't do without music.
Mm.
And I'd say, well, I could do without the music, but I couldn't do without books.
Right, me too. I think I'm the same.
Because my problem now is that I live with hundreds of them because I get so many to review. And I think, oh, I do want to read that. I can't interview the author because they're in Timbuktu or whatever, but I do want to read it. So I'll just put it aside. So I don't have a filing system. I have a piling system. And I have to negotiate my way through the piles to get to bed. And I'm sharing a queen-size bed with a dozen books at a time.
I envy you. How often do you get to interview authors and speak to authors?
Well, that's my validity of doing it, too.
I love that. That's great.
So with book lovers, generally speaking, book lovers have a lot of books and also collect books.
True. And can't bear to part with
them. What's the fine line between collecting books and being a hoarder?
No, I'm a hoarder.
Ah, there you go.
You are self.
There you are. Yeah, I've said it out loud and publicly. I'm a hoarder.
What about you, Andrew?
You know, I think it's the only thing that I'm sentimental about is my book collection.
Yeah.
I'll throw anything away, get rid of old furniture, put it on hard garbage, anything. But yeah, my books are very dear to me. Whenever I move, it's
the books.
Yeah. Part of the move is just boxes of books and a couple of other things.
When my first husband and I separated, he took his immediate possessions and his Victor Sylvester long playing CD, it wasn't a CD then, and the two books he owned. When I married my second husband and he moved in, we were able to get rid of half our books between us because we had so many of the same books.
Oh, really? Over
the years. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. They were both great book readers. But I couldn't live without books. I was an only child, an older parent, and they were my best friends.
Mm.
And I really feel the kids now, you see them with the mobile phone. I'm reading a lovely book at the moment. It's called The Bookshop of the Broken Hearted. And it's by a Victorian author named Robert Hillman.
Okay.
That's a lovely story.
Yeah. What's the genre?
It's set in a country town, and Tom is a plodder, a real part-time farmer, part-time handyman, who marries a girl from the city who only stays for 12 months and then leaves him and takes their baby.
Mm.
And he's lost and lonely. And then an older woman comes to town, and it's set back not too long after the war, and she's a Jewish refugee from Hungary. And it's told chapter by chapter, their attitudes and their lives, and we discover that she's been through Auschwitz and lost her husband and her own little boy throughout it. Oh, and it's beautifully written. And she opens the bookshop in town with this massive collection of books, spends her entire money, fortune that she's brought with it, small fortune, on books. And the townspeople think she's mad, but they indulge her. And he goes to put in the bookshelves and refurbish the shop, and they fall in love and marry.
Nice. Okay.
It's just a beautiful story, beautifully written. And for anybody who loves books, you know, she refers to War and Peace and Dostoevsky and, of course, all the classics. Books he's never heard of, and she encourages him to read little by little by little, and he's drawn into them.
I like that.
So you'd probably enjoy it.
I would. The romanticism of it, not so much the romance, but the starting a bookshop in a small town.
I'm not a great lover of romance either. Yeah, rural romance.
Yeah. I mean, more the idea of starting your own bookshop. What a thing to do. I'll do that one day, maybe. That'll be the final piece in the being a book person puzzle. Yeah. Having your own bookshop.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Roughly how long are your readings each day?
I read one chapter per day.
But how long was it?
About 10 minutes. Mm. Anywhere from some of the shorter chapters are 4 minutes. They're one page long. And then some of the longer ones might be 20 minutes.
Mm.
But if you average it out, about 10 minutes. And then probably about 5 minutes of discussion about the chapter afterwards.
And I imagine you're faced with a lot of difficult surnames.
I completely butcher the pronunciation of all the towns' names. And that's
interesting.
Part of the charm of the podcast, I think, is that I am a novice. So it's not an expert teaching you, lecturing you about
from a superior stance.
Right. No, it's kind of like I'm a bit of a bumbling idiot. I mess everything up. But you get to experience the book through the eyes of someone learning.
Come and join me.
Learn along with me sort of thing.
Mm.
I've had some feedback from readers who said they've read the book a few times, but listening to the podcast gave them that vicarious feeling of reading it for the first time because they're hearing me for the first time.
With your eyes.
Yeah, that was a nice little byproduct. Yeah.
Because it adds another dimension, because if Anne could read a chapter, I could read a chapter, but the emphasis of how you emphasise the words or pronounce the words or get into a bit of a pacing or a groove or whatever, it probably adds to each person.
Or even how you interpret it.
Interpret it,
Interpret that certain too. Emotions.
And that's what's great about the community, because there's 2,000 people reading along. You miss things and people point it out and go, I reckon that was a hint towards this.
How did
this.
I miss that?
Yeah, yeah. Different theories, everything, it's really cool.
So with the story, when there's characters speaking and whatever, do you get into a sort of a personality of that?
No, I don't do voices.
I don't like that in a book, really.
Oh, really? Yeah, me too. I'm not much of a voice actor, so I wouldn't attempt
well, particularly if a man is trying to emulate a female voice or vice versa, it just doesn't ring true, does it?
No. All I try to do is change the tone of my voice slightly to so that you can hear that it's the start of dialogue or different people speaking, but I don't put on a voice for different characters. Yeah.
How can people access it?
The podcast is called A Year of War and Peace. So if you've got a podcast app or the iTunes one or whatever, you can just search for A Year of War and Peace, or you can visit the website A Year of War and Peace at .podbean.com.
Well, wow. If you email that through to me, I'm going to write the column for the program this week. I'll make sure I pass on
those details. Yeah, yep.
So how many more days have we got to go? We're 270.
Yeah.
I don't do sums.
The math, about 100, I think. Well, until the end of the year. It times out. It should end right around the end of the year. We're not quite sure because different translations of the novel have more or less chapters.
Oh, do they?
Slightly.
That's interesting.
And I'm not sure the precise number of chapters in my translation, but it should end near enough to New Year's. Yeah, give or take a few days.
Okay. And are you doing any writing as well?
Oh, yeah, I am. I'm working on a literary fiction novel set in a sort of fictional, rural, coastal Victorian town, which it's kind of one of those novels. It's my third novel, but I think it'll never see the light of day. It's kind of a personal project. And the more I write it, it's nearly finished. And I just think, I don't know about this book. So I think...
not a rural romance.
It's not a romance, no. It's about a man whose partner goes missing, and he joins the missing person's search. And as it becomes kind of a cold case and it becomes less and less likely they'll find her, he becomes more and more manic in his search and sort of obsessed.
I'm loving the sound of it.
It turns him a bit nutty. Yeah.
Frantic.
Have you got a title for it?
It's called Personal Fable. That's the working title. It was called originally Until We Meet Again, but my friend Robbie, who came here with us last time, he told me that sounds like a Nicholas Sparks novel.
Oh,
so I went, no, you're absolutely right.
You have to be careful with the titles.
So I went away with that. Now it's called Personal Fable.
Oh, I'm going to start nagging you about that.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'm passionate about? My next book I want to write will be set on a cruise ship. And it's about a...
Hell on Water.
Yeah, Ship of Fools.
That's kind of title.
Hell on Water. That's not bad.
It doesn't sound like a Love Boat so far. Come on.
No, it's about a retired mob boss. Mm. It's meant to be a bit funny. You know, I've been reading Terry Pratchett, and it's been
this revelation to me.
I want to write something funny.
Fabulous.
So I've come up with this idea. A semi-retired mob boss can't quite retire because he keeps getting roped back into all the dealings, right? So on his wife's orders, they take a cruise, a three-month cruise, where he's unable to access that world. No phone reception.
Clean break.
Escape.
Right. Yeah. So one of those mega cruises. But he's unable to, you know, break his habits, and he sort of recreates his crime ring in the confines of
the boat.
A microcosm of his own world on the boat.
Some habits don't die, do they?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then to counter that, there's a retired police chief who is on the same cruise and, again, can't help himself but to try to investigate and stop this retired mob boss.
It's an interesting theme.
So they recreate their worlds. Yeah, it's kind of that wherever you go, there you are sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
What a great premise. What a great...
It's a premise which lends itself to being funny, which I hope to achieve.
Yeah. Oh, the scope's there.
Yeah.
When you're writing, do you visualise your characters physically?
Physically? No, you know what? I don't go in much with physical descriptions of characters. Mm. Something I learned from Tolstoy especially is he doesn't either. Unless those physical attributes lend... description to their personality. Mm. So it's
they have a role in themselves, the look of a person, a very beautiful person, a scarred person.
War and Peace has 500 characters.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. And so he needs to get good at expressing who the character is in minimal words because he can't be spending all this time describing what they look like.
No.
So if he was to say they had blue eyes, it's kind of like, well, what kind of person has blue eyes? Doesn't really tell you much about their personalities.
It's irrelevant, isn't it?
Right. So the only physical descriptions he'll give are ones that might hint towards their personality, like he had hunched shoulders or That, you know, that kind
more
of
thing. More of constant frown.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
If there's a characteristic of that person, that would may also accentuate his attitude or his behaviour of sorts, you think.
Right, right. Yeah, he's not going to waste words describing what they look like unless it tells you what they are like as well.
It's relevant to the plot otherwise, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
What did you read as a kid?
Roald Dahl.
Oh, yes.
A lot of Roald Dahl.
Yeah. Well, you would. If you like Terry Pratchett, then of course you'd enjoy Roald Dahl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Paul Jennings too.
Yeah.
I like just silly books, I think. And then I discovered Roald Dahl again as an adult, only learning in my 20s that he wrote for adults as well. And that was a beautiful thing because it was like the same familiar voice, but now he was addressing me as
an adult
grown-up. Yeah. It was really nice.
It's a bit like that with the Darrells. The Darrell, Lawrence Darrell and his brother.
Oh, okay. Not familiar.
Oh, you would have enjoyed those.
Oh, really? So they wrote for children and for...
Initially, one brother more or less wrote for children, and then the other one wrote quite beautiful novels. Yeah, look them up. You'd enjoy them.
I will do that.
There's a series. I can't remember what it was called now, but Lawrence Darrell wrote three books and three different personalities. Each book was dedicated to a particular character, and they cross one another's paths throughout the books. Yeah.
I'd love to write for children, younger sort of children.
Yeah, well, when you work with kids so much, you should be well qualified to do that.
Well, I've edited and worked with 1,600 kids now. I've published through Launchpad.
You keep count.
Oh, yeah, I do, because each book has the amount of kids in it.
Oh, I see.
Keep a tally. So I've edited, proofread, and helped to write 1,600 or so stories. It's about that, I think.
Have you got any potential geniuses coming through?
Oh, I do. Actually, this is pretty cool. This is a bit of a side note, but the very first Launchpad program back at Middle King Lake 2015, there was a boy. His name's Aaron. And he he said to me, I'll work on this short story. But I'll have to pause working on my novel for a little bit.
How old was he?
He was in grade six.
Oh, that's amazing. Love it.
Yeah, and so here I am thinking that I'm helping his literary career progress. I'm actually getting in the way of it.
Yeah, intruding into his personal time.
Right. So then a few years later I started an after-school club for kids who wanted to pursue being an author. And Aaron was one of the first kids to sign up.
Great, yeah.
Right, and then earlier this year, he emails me to say, hey, I just finished my first novel.
Is this the one he was still working on?
No, he gave up on that one, but he started a new one. It's called Live a Little, and it's a science fiction kind of cozy mystery, murder mystery thing.
Mm.
Really funny too. He's a big fan of Douglas Adams. And his whole family actually have a very British humour about them.
I like British humour.
Yes, I think we all do, don't we?
Yeah.
It's so subtle.
Well,
not always Monty Python.
Not as sarcastic as American side of things.
No, not as blatant,
it's
is
a bit dry, dry humour.
Yeah.
But I read his book in between Terry Pratchett books and it stood up in terms of entertaining.
It's a harsh
funny
test.
Yeah, yep.
Mm.
So I said to him, I've got an independent publishing label, among other things that I do, Up and Up Media.
A man for all seasons.
Right. So
another book.
Yeah, yeah. Up and Up Media's only ever put out one book. And it was a compilation book. We spoke about that last time. But I've been looking for a novel to put out, but I needed it to be something that I could promote.
Mm.
And I didn't want it to be like self-publishing someone's work. I wanted to choose something, promote it, do a book tour. And then when he submitted this book, I just thought, that's it. That's going to be the first Up and Up Media release. So I'm actually publishing this book that he's written.
Oh, terrific. And when can we expect to see that?
Early next year.
Oh,
I'm hoping
good.
Around March next year.
Your review
copy. Yeah, oh, definitely. I'll bring Aaron in too if you want to speak to him.
That'd be great.
Yeah, he's in
he's booked.
Year 10 now.
Consider him booked.
Yeah, he's a good kid. He's a really good kid. Great writer. He's, When I met him, he was in grade six, and he showed me the novel he was working on. And it was one of those moments like, damn it, like this is better than what I can do. He's got all that.
So you learned from him at certain things.
Very much so. I'm still asking him, because the way his murder mystery unfolds is so complex and perfectly paced. I'm asking, how do you plan something like that?
So difficult. I'm always interested with a crime writer to ask them that. How far ahead? And it's, I'm amazed by how often they say, well, I didn't really know until I was halfway through the book.
That's what Aaron told me,
And some characters, like I've heard this many times with authors, characters take a life of their own.
They do, yeah, they do.
And it changes the story as it unfolds. Does that something happen with your writing?
Yeah. You know what? I'm more of a planner, though. So I'm a strict planner. I spend months.
You'd have to be organised to live the life you do and cope with all the things you do. No, truly.
I do. I put little lists together of what I'll do today, and it's like an hour of editing, an hour of launchpad, be here by that time, you know.
So, time management. Time
terrifying. Management. Yeah, terrifying.
Excellent.
What's your astrological sign?
Capricorn.
I'm not surprised.
is that a Capricorn thing?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Self-disciplened.
That's what I'm preaching to my students all the time. I say, forget about inspiration and motivation and all that.
It's discipline.
You need discipline if you're going to finish a book, because it takes a lot of hours.
My excuse for everything is that I'm an Aquarian.
Oh, okay.
But I tell you what, it takes a big commitment, though, doesn't it? Particularly a young person who's got so many distractions and so many other things that his mates are doing or friends are doing, and he stays focused on his book.
Really
his
impressive.
Writing.
I couldn't have done it at that age.
You'd have to make sacrifices still.
Well, his parents tell me that he loves it. He doesn't sit and watch TV unless it's Doctor Who, they tell me. But he sits and writes.
Doesn't have a mobile phone in his hand all the time.
He probably does. I think he does.
Not all the time.
Well, no, he's not attached to it like that. Yeah.
But I guess if you've got a passion, that's where you're fired up and the energy comes from that.
Yeah, he's so disciplined. See, with writing a book, I used to be more of a music background in bands and writing songs. And the cool thing about that is you can stay excited about a song long enough to finish it and record it.
And then you'd lose interest.
Right, yeah, but the inspiration lasts long enough to get the project finished. But with writing, you know, that inspiration wears off sometimes a year before you've finished and then it becomes just discipline.
A discipline.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when you're excited, like I am right now, to start the next project.
Yeah. Can't wait for it. Yeah. You want to get this one out of the way. Well, you obviously can't with this one. You are committed.
Well, like I said, I'm going to finish this one I'm writing, and it'll probably never see the light of day.
Mm. Oh no, I was thinking of your daily project.
Oh, the War and Peace one. Well, I've got a few thousand people who will be very disappointed, even if I missed a day.
Well, they'll hound you if you don't, if you let it go.
I'm impressed with myself. 200. I think it's 285 days today. I'm impressed that I've done anything 285 days in a row.
That's
I'm
amazing.
Impressed.
Yeah.
Enormously. Are you enjoying the book?
Yeah, yeah.
That's fundamental, I guess. If you weren't enjoying it, it would be sheer torture. Oh, God, here we go again.
It'd be like a chore, wouldn't it? So it hasn't got to that point of being a chore. You've still got that passion of putting it out every day.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, there are days. There are days when...
I don't want to do this.
Yeah, I don't get home until after midnight and I think, oh, no, I've still got to do the podcast. And there's days when the chapter is like an exposition chapter. He sort of zooms out away from the characters and gives you this overview of what's happening between Napoleon and Russia, and it's a bit dry, but that's scattered throughout the book. That's not often.
And that's when the discipline has to be applied.
Yeah, yeah.
It's you a job. It has to be done. Get on with it.
That's right. But, you know, because the good thing is that I can then lend my own commentary to that, so I can make a joke about how dry was that chapter, or I can vent about it or make light of it. So
you obviously build up great rapport with the other people who are reading it too.
Yeah, yeah, I think they enjoy it. You know, I've had nearly 50,000 downloads of this project. Oh, isn't that crazy?
Somebody's reading it. Yeah. 50,000.
50,000. I started it thinking, will this take off? Will anyone be into this? Probably not. It's a pretty dry subject matter. And
what have you created? A monster.
I'm thinking of continuing it next year with another book. We're still trying to decide which book, but keep it going.
Do you know if anybody else is doing the same thing with the other books?
I don't think so. Yeah. I know that there are podcasts where they do like an audio book of a book, something older in the public domain.
Quarter to one in the mornings, quarter to two in the morning, the ABC has a 15-minute book reading.
Oh, really?
Every night.
Is it a continued series? I read the same book.
Yeah, yeah, they wrote through. And I, you know Michael Veitch's name.
Right, yeah.
He did one earlier this year, and he was a guest in the studio. He's a friend of a friend as well. And I started a new one by him last week, and I sent him an email saying, how come I haven't caught up with this new book? You haven't sent me a copy. And he emailed me back and said, what new book? And I mentioned it by name, and he said, I wrote that in 2011. I said, didn't the ABC tell you they were going to replay it? And he said, nope, not a word.
Oh, wow.
And I said, don't you get royalties or anything? And he said, I wish. So there you go.
Wow, okay. Yeah. We think you would get some royalties, wouldn't you?
You would, wouldn't you?
I think so, yeah.
Is it him reading it?
He's reading it.
Oh, so it's a pre-recorded one and they're just playing it.
He read the book, you know, at the time, and people could have access to the book. And obviously the ABC have been sitting on it.
I would go to AMRAP or somebody to see what the copyright and the royalties are on that one.
He's just shrugged it off.
So strange that they didn't let him know.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. I mean, out of common courtesy.
Absolutely.
One would. I mean, there was no mention of when it was. It's just that we've got a new book reading, Michael Veitch reading, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And off they went.
What do you guys think of this idea? I'm floating this with my audience as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what to do after the year's up?
Yes.
There's a famous list of books that Hemingway wrote for an aspiring writer.
Ah, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, the guy asked him, what book should I read to become a great author? Hemingway wrote a list of 16 books, I think. I think it's 14 novels and 2 short stories. Mm. And one of them is War and Peace. And there's some James Joyce, there's some more Tolstoy.
Oh, that'll be a challenge, James Joyce.
Right, yeah, Dublin as it is, yeah. So I thought, well, maybe that can be how the podcast continues. We make our way through this list of books that Hemingway recommends.
That gives you structure, doesn't it, if you've got that to refer to. I was interested to hear that at the Royal Wedding they had a reading from Scott Fitzgerald, from Gatsby, the great Gatsby.
No kidding. Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
Apparently she's a fan of his writing.
Of course, if you start on another book, it may not have those short chapters. What are you going to do then?
Yeah, well, that's something I've considered as well.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you can just break it up in some other way, or do longer. There might be longer chapters, but a shorter book all up, so it won't take a whole year.
Mm.
Do it like a Saturday matinee. Leave them, you know, as a cliffhanger every week, so they have to come in for the next episode.
Yeah, that's it. You got it.
Well, Tolstoy does that anyway. Not each chapter, but quite often he'll end the chapter on a cliffhanger.
That's a charming little book I've just read. The author's coming in later today.
What's it called?
I'm not going to try and pronounce it again. You read
The Road to Trelfamadore.
sorry, I didn't hear that. What was it again?
Trelfamador or Madore. Blaise Van Heck.
So a small independent publishing house called Busy Bird.
Blaise, I think I know Blaise.
She's a publicist with them as well as an author.
Yeah.
She's written Blaise. Other things.
Very cool.
It's going to be good to hear another interpretation of that title coming up soon.
Well, it's actually based, there was a hippie village set up here in Victoria with that title, and that's what she's writing about.
Oh, really?
It's fiction or non-fiction?
Not fiction. It's her childhood.
Oh, right. Gotcha.
Her hippie childhood.
I gotcha. Yep.
Yeah. Fantastic.
We'll find out a little bit later on the program of Good Life.
Well, you've been very generous with your time today. We'll have to let you go home and work on your project. Finish the novel so you can come back next time.
I'm sure I've got something I can work on. Yeah.
I'm sure you have. I hope you don't get an Uber call out today.
Disrupt you. I did some this morning, I'm done with that for the day. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you found your way.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Fun.
Always a pleasure.
Yes.
Keep us posted with all those activities.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I'll bring Aaron in when he's finished his... when his novel's out, yeah.
Terrific. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Anne.
We've been talking to Andrew Lewis and listening to Good Life on 3MDR 97.1.